Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Gourmet Foods, 120 Krispy Kreme Drive in Bloomington, featuring over 400 kinds of chocolates and more. Daily tasting and an extensive Saturday tasting party with over 50 items. Information at 309-663-2222 or at worldgourmetfoods.com. Bringing the taste of the world to Bloomington Normal.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Each August, birds that have summered in the Arctic begin their long migration south. They will leave their breeding areas for their wintering grounds. On the program today, we're going to talk with conservation biologist Stephen Brown about this amazing migration. We'll also talk with him about what the summer months are like on the tundra, where dozens and dozens of species of birds come to nest and rear their young. There on the tundra are all kinds of birds, shorebirds, waterfowl, owls, raptors, gulls, terns, and songbirds. Let's listen to something that will help us imagine the scene. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Stephen Brown is the director of the Shorebird Conservation Research Program for the Manomet Center for Conservation Sciences. The lead author on the U.S. Shorebird Conservation Plan, Stephen Brown is the editor of the new book, Arctic Wings, Birds of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The book comes with a CD of bird songs recorded on the refuge. We heard one of the tracks of the CD just a moment ago. Listeners, I welcome your questions and comments for our guest, conservation biologist Stephen Brown. You can join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Stephen Brown, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks very much for having me.
The sounds we heard a moment ago are just amazing. What's it like to be surrounded by these birds? What's it like to be out there on the refuge?
Well, one of the most remarkable things about working on the Alaskan tundra is that during the summer months, the sun never sets. It's so far north that it's above the Arctic Circle, where during the summer, the sunlight is up 24 hours a day. So we're used to, in the lower 48, having bird songs just be a daylight thing where they come alive in the morning and sing. And on the tundra, there's that kind of bird song pretty much all day, and there are some cycles. They quiet down a bit toward evening when the sun gets a little lower. But to me, one of the most remarkable things is how much activity is packed into such a short summer season, and the birds are constantly calling and singing, and it's just a very lovely sound.
Yeah, so basically, are they at work most of the day? I mean, all day long?
They are. They have a bit of a cycle where as the sun gets low in the evening, and it never sets, but it kind of comes down close to the horizon, and so it does get cooler, and it looks very much like that lovely long evening light, which is very, very pretty anywhere in the world, but lasts for many, many hours up there. And during that period, they'll be a little bit quieter, but they're still active and in many cases out foraging and trying to pack a great deal of activity into their very short summer.
Mm. How many species come to this area, this coastal plain of the refuge each year?
Well, the official total right now is 194 different species of birds that have been recorded somewhere in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. And of those, about 157 have been recorded out on the coastal plain. That's the tundra area right along the Arctic Ocean.
There are so many species here. Is there a great range in habitat in the refuge?
There really is. It's a remarkable range of habitats, and it's actually our only complete example of all of the Arctic ecosystems in a protected area, because you start on the north with the tundra, and the coastal plain comes right up to the Arctic Ocean, where you find coastal habitats, beachfront and lagoon systems. Then you, as you move south, you go through tundra habitats up into the foothills, which are drier and higher, and then into the Brooks Range, which is a very majestic mountain range. And then as you cross even farther south down into the southern part of the Arctic Refuge, you come into boreal forest. So there's an enormous range of habitats, and this is the only place where we've protected a complete collection of Arctic ecosystems.
How was it that this area of Alaska, how is it that it came to be protected?
Well, it was originally set aside as the Arctic National Wildlife Range, and then was under the Alaska National Interest Land Conservation Act in 1980. It was increased in size and redesignated as the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And since then, it's been protected as a wildlife refuge. Although it's important to realize that while part of the refuge is designated as wilderness and is therefore protected from development, that's the Brooks Range. The coastal plain is the area that's been under so much discussion about what its future should be. Should it be protected as a wildlife area, or should it be opened for oil and gas development?
Hmm. What's the record of oil fields in Alaska regarding conservation and regarding protecting habitat?
Well, it's an improving record, which is important. The oil companies have worked hard, but nevertheless, there's a long string of oil-related accidents. There were several spills just recently that are typical things where oil is unexpectedly escapes from, in this case, the pipeline. And so the development for oil inevitably brings with it large numbers of spills of various sizes. And so there are a lot of different kinds of impacts that happen from oil development, and spills are probably the most dramatic that people think about. But also, there's a significant loss of habitat just related to the platform of the facilities themselves. And we tend to think of an oil facility as just the wellhead, the things you'd see in the lower 48. And you forget that in the tundra, which is basically a large wetland, all of that infrastructure has to be built on gravel pads. So there's a lot of filling that's involved with building roads and building houses for people and oil processing and pumping facilities. There's a lot of infrastructure that's associated with it. So even though the oil companies have done what they can to minimize those impacts, there's still a significant impact just from the footprint of the area that's developed.
Mm. And the proposal that we've been talking about lately, we've been debating most recently, how would that proposal for drilling and exploration and production affect habitat and the birds that depend on that habitat in this area of the refuge that we're talking about today?
Well, it's a very important question. And, of course, it's difficult to predict exactly how the impacts would play out, given the uncertainties with respect to how it would be developed. There are a couple of important things, and the proposal that's been most recently submitted to Congress includes the idea that the footprint would be limited to 2,000 acres. So if you think on first blush, that's a very small piece of what's about 1.5 million acres of coastal tundra. But that footprint only includes the immediate facilities related to the oil, actual oil wells, and it doesn't include things like gravel mines for finding the gravel to use on the construction of all those pits. It doesn't include airstrips. It doesn't include associated facilities. So the footprint itself would be much bigger than just those 2,000 acres. But beyond that, there's a lot of uncertainty about where oil might be located if it exists under the refuge. Estimates vary very dramatically about how much oil is actually there. And so without knowing where they might find oil if exploration went forward, it's difficult. But there is one important pattern that we can note even at this point, which is that of the oil wells just to the west, outside of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in state land that's currently under production, many of the active oil wells are located very close to the coast. And we also know that inside the Arctic Refuge, many of the most productive bird habitats, particularly for the shorebirds that I study, are very close to the coast as well. So there's at least the potential that if development were to occur, the clustering of facilities along the coast would make the impact much larger on birds that prefer the habitats that are located very near the coast.
Yeah. Shorebirds are a type of bird, a family of birds, that face a lot of challenges, don't they?
That's very true. They're one of the groups of birds that's most at risk from ongoing problems throughout the hemisphere. And they have really extraordinary lifestyles that give them lots of challenges along the way. Most of the shorebirds that come to the Arctic are only there in the breeding season. And then many of them set out on truly remarkable migrations that take them, in some cases, as far as the southern tip of South America. And they do that in both directions each year. So along the way, they're facing a number of risks, from habitat loss along their migration routes to habitat loss in their wintering grounds, and then also impacts from toxic chemicals and changes in predator populations and lots of other impacts. So of the shorebirds that we have in North America, we believe about half of them are in fairly serious trouble, and that's from the results of a collection of scientists that got together and collaborated with the development of the Shorebird Conservation Plan, which was an effort to understand the status as best as we can of all of those different shorebird species.
Yeah, that's a lot of birds in trouble.
It is, and it's difficult to know exactly what to do about it because we're very limited by a lack of knowledge. You can imagine that it's very challenging to try to understand what limits the population of a bird that has different impacts that could be happening all the way from Alaska to Argentina, and they are covering these huge amounts of area, so even finding a bird a second time is a difficult challenge.
Yeah. What are some of the questions you and other conservation biologists are working on in an effort to gain a greater understanding of birds, their behavior, their migration, their habitat needs?
Well, the biggest question we had when we set out to do this particular study that we've just finished in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge was to try to understand just how important the area is for breeding shorebirds. And that's because while other animals like caribou and polar bears that are much better known, and most people when they think about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge think about caribou or polar bears, and there's been a fair amount of research on those species, and so we understand their habitat needs fairly well. In contrast, the birds of the Arctic Refuge are much less well known. In fact, in the process of collecting all the information we did for Arctic Wings, we actually added 11 species to the list of birds that have been recorded in the refuge just by collecting records from the different collaborators who are involved in the book. So there's really a lot that we don't know, even though, you know, it's the new century. We're still struggling to get basic knowledge about many of these birds. So we set out to do the first comprehensive survey that had ever been done of the entire coastal plain area. It's sometimes called the 1002 area because it was set aside for special study in Section 1002 of that state of that Alaska National Interest Land Conservation Act that set up the refuge. And so that whole area had never been systematically surveyed for shorebirds. And just to give you a quick idea, we ended up calculating that there are approximately 230,000 shorebirds that use that area for breeding every year. And that's somewhere around 2% of the population of these birds that exist in North America. That doesn't sound like too much at first. When you stop and think about it, though, it's the only protected area that they use for breeding. And it's also, if you think about it as a percentage of the population of the U.S., it would be about the same as the populations of Boston, Detroit, Chicago, Denver and San Francisco combined as a proportion of the population of the United States. So it is an important place for preserving nesting habitat for these birds, which we know are already in decline.
Yeah. What are the characteristics of this family of birds, shorebirds?
Well, shorebirds are a pretty diverse group. They're defined by their taxonomic relationships, but they include a really interesting range of birds, from ones that are dependent on wetlands to ones that use more upland habitats. And their characteristics include having relatively long legs, and that's an adaptation to the fact that many of them forage in the shallow water. They tend to have very long and swept back pointed wings, which is an adaptation to their flight. And what that allows them to do is fly very fast, which is very helpful when you're setting out from Alaska to fly all the way to Argentina. It's a long trip. And so there are a very wide range of different body types and habitat types within that. But those are things that they have in common. And some common ones, if people aren't familiar with them, are things like an American golden plover is a common spring migrant in your area. And there historically were very, very many more American golden plovers in the world that would come up through the central part of the United States and their spring migration headed north. And in the fall, you have species like the pectoral sandpiper or the semi-palmated sandpiper that are moving south on their migrations. So those are some more familiar birds that may be familiar to some of your listeners.
Yeah. And there might be, and there are other birds that we are familiar with that might also make this long journey. We're in the, Illinois is in the Mississippi Flyway.
Right.
So what birds might we see pass through our backyards as they migrate in the spring and the fall, in addition to, say, the golden plover?
Well, some of those, especially in the fall, you have some fairly large numbers of shorebirds coming south. And so you'll have large numbers of least sandpipers, which actually breed up in the boreal, and then the semi-palmated sandpiper is a very small sandpiper that, even though it's such a tiny bird, flies all the way to South America. And pectoral sandpipers are another common one that move through the middle of the country in large numbers. And you even have other songbirds that come from the Arctic, like Lapland longspurs, which are a very common breeder up in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
And the white-crowned sparrow.
Yeah, and you know, it's really remarkable that there are so many different species in so many different kinds of habitats, and yet pretty much anywhere in the lower 48 you can find species that also occur up in the Arctic.
Yeah. Now, the sandpipers, in this part of the country, we would have to be along a waterway, wouldn't we?
You can, but they don't need to be large bodies of water. Some shorebirds, like solitary sandpipers, are very commonly found around the edges of small ponds, even stock ponds, and some are common around the edges of small streams and rivers, like spotted sandpipers. So they use such a wide range of habitats that you can find shorebirds in many, many different kinds of wetlands of varying depths. And
So what can we do to protect these habitats that we might have very close to home, might be part of our yard?
Yeah, well, in terms of the birds I work with, wetland protection is the very most important, and it's particularly important for migration. And one of the challenges about that is that you could go out to a wetland in many parts of the country, like where you are, and not see birds on many days of the year. And yet, nevertheless, those birds are engaged in this enormous migration. And as they pass through, they're in desperate need to stop and feed and gain weight to continue their migration. So particularly up through the Great Plains, small numbers of birds trickle through over the migration season. But collectively, those small wetlands amount to being a very important habitat. And even though you don't see many birds there at one time, they can provide habitat for many birds over the course of the season. So a lot of those small wetlands are increasingly at risk. There have been changes in the interpretation of federal law that question whether or not they're actually protected under the Clean Water Act. And the removal of those protections will lead to the loss of significant numbers of small wetlands that are, at these important times of year, very important to migrating birds.
Mm. The terrain, the landscape a bird flies over can change so much in the course of a season. Human development can affect the landscape, obviously. So too, a big storm like a hurricane.
Right.
How does that affect migrating birds? Does that throw them off? I mean, they have to stop somewhere and get, you know, and fuel up, if you will,
right,
to continue their migration. But does it get them off track?
Well, birds are remarkably adaptable. So we've changed the face of the landscape in this country quite dramatically over the course of European settlement. And they've been managed, for the most part, to adapt to many of the changes. What's critical is that we preserve some places where they can maintain these migratory patterns. So they're conducting this migration from the Arctic to Argentina, and they're not going to get lost if a particular wetland is not there. But what happens over time is that as habitat is gradually degraded and fewer areas are available, they begin to have trouble finding enough to eat along the way. And so imagine like you're setting out on a long trip. They have to almost double their body weight in order to complete some of these migrations. And then they use that stored fat as a fuel source as they're flying. And many of them land and need to refuel and find food to carry on with their journey. So as more and more stopover habitats are lost, it becomes more and more difficult for them to do that. So that's probably the most important aspect of preserving wetlands on a local scale, is that they play an important role in this very large hemispheric migration.
Mm. So protecting habitat is critical. How much and where, though?
Well, that's a difficult question, and a lot of conservation groups work very hard on that issue to try to understand what are the most important habitats. And so we've worked hard at U.S. sort of what conservation biologists are working on, and that's probably one of the issues that's most at the forefront of conservation biology, trying to understand what are the most critical habitats and basically what's enough to support migratory species as they come through. And in that context, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge becomes even more important. It's the only area that we've set aside for protection that's up on the coastal tundra of Alaska. So for the birds to be hatched there and set out on these migrations, they need protected habitat. And the same is true then on migration. Determining exactly how much stopover habitat is needed is very difficult. And we work on that by trying to understand how many birds move through an area, what kinds of habitats they use. And I work with some colleagues in the plains to try to understand which small wetland habitats are most important. But it's a difficult question.
Yeah, because some species travel in long flights, others in short flights.
Right.
Others in short flights. So maybe you would talk with us a bit about, you know, what's a long hop, what's a short hop?
Well, that's a good question. And if you think about golden plovers, we were talking about them earlier, on the spring migration, they tend to move through the Great Plains in what would be called a short hop migration, where their flights would be on the order of tens to hundreds of miles, and they're moving from wetland to wetland as they go. In the fall, they have one of the largest single flights that shorebirds do. They come from Alaska and the Canadian Arctic over to the Northeast and then depart directly for South America across the Atlantic Ocean, which is a nonstop flight of about 2,500 miles.
Mm.
So that's what we call a long hop. And they're only able to do that if they've been able to store a significant amount of fat reserves in order to fuel them for that entire migratory hop. And if they don't have significant or sufficient resources, they simply run out of fuel along the way, and then there's no place for them to land, so they end up falling into the ocean.
Mm. Our guest this afternoon is Stephen Brown. He's the director of the Shorebird Conservation Research Program for the Manomet Center for Conservation Sciences. He's the lead author on the U.S. Shorebird Conservation Plan, and he is also the editor of the new book, Arctic Wings, Birds of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions or comments. Here are the phone numbers if you'd like to join us. 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Here's a question you ask and then write about in your essay in Arctic Wings. Why would a semi-palmated sandpiper, which weighs about as much as a AA battery, go to all the trouble of flying from South America to the Arctic to reproduce and then leave the Arctic for the long flight back to its wintering grounds? Why did they do it?
It doesn't seem like a winning strategy.
No.
Glance, does it?
No.
Well, of course, these things evolve over long, long time periods, and so we can only speculate about what we think drives those migrations. But we do know that a couple of things distinguish the breeding grounds when they're there. One is that there's an enormous flush of insects that makes a huge amount of food available to them, and it comes at just the critical time when their chicks are starting to grow and need to very quickly develop from being a tiny little fluff ball into a bird that can fly to Argentina. They have only a short few weeks to do that, and so they need a very large input of basically protein and carbohydrates to build their little bodies up into these flight machines that they become. And so the availability of food appears to be a major evolutionary driver for why they have selected these habitats. Another is that because the winter is so harsh, the populations of predators that can be supported in the northern landscapes tend to be smaller than in more southern areas. So although predation is a big issue and many, many shorebird nests are destroyed by predators, nevertheless, they're probably doing better up there where, for example, the Arctic fox population has to survive the winter and then carry on into the breeding season before they can start being an impact on birds. So those are probably two of the most important reasons.
Yeah. Also, that issue of daylight, I suspect that that could play a role as well. You could eat, you know, all day long.
That's right. And so if you're a species that can only forage when it's light, you have a much longer day in which to try to collect all the food that you need.
Do we have any idea how long this has been going on?
Well, it's always difficult to measure precisely, but we know that as long as the North Slope was ice-free, and back millions of years, there's been ice-free tundra. So even during some of the glacial cycles that have come and gone since then, we believe there's still been shorebirds doing these migrations up to these tundra areas. And it's a migration that's been going on for uncounted thousands and millions of years. And so when we think about what's happening in our lifetime, which is this decision that faces us right now, do we preserve the last 5% of the Arctic as a wildlife habitat, or do we develop even that last 5% for oil? We need to weigh it in the context of this millennia-long migration pattern that we're in danger of disrupting.
Mm. Is there fossil evidence there in the Arctic of what has happened in the past?
You know, I'm not really an expert on fossils, and so I can't really speak to that. But I do know that because the temperature is so low, you know, things are preserved pretty well. But it's difficult to find, you know, bird fossils pretty much anywhere because they're very light-boned, and so their adaptation to flight makes them also harder to find than, say, larger animals like mammals, which have much more that's apt to fossilize.
Mm. Tell us about the people who worked on this book. It's a coffee table-sized book. I mentioned that it has the CD inside. It has amazing photographs. Tell us about the essayists, the people who did the writing, the people whose photographs appear here.
Well, the photographs were collected mostly by about five of the really the best photographers working in the Arctic today. And the first was Shubhankar Banerjee, who published a book called Seasons of Life and Land, which did a great deal to bring attention to the landscape and the value of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And some of the other photographers particularly focus on birds, and it's extremely demanding to try to have the patience to wait days and days and days to try to get just the right photograph. So I have a great deal of admiration for the work that's reflected here. It's just a really remarkable collection of photographs.
Hmm. We're speaking to one another in mid-July. If you were there today, out there on the tundra, what would the scene be like?
Well, I'm actually on my way there in just a few days. And so what's happening right now in terms of shorebird activity is they've largely finished nesting, and the chicks have hatched, and they're starting to move out onto the tundra. So we're going to be going up to look at which coastal habitats are most important for the young birds. And remember, they're now getting ready for this large migration all the way to South America. So in the next month, they need to finish developing their flight feathers, put on weight, and try to be ready to leave. So they're right now moving out from the tundra habitats where they hatched, out onto the coastal plain, and then out onto the mud flats along the Arctic Ocean, and trying to get ready for this enormous migration.
Mm-hmm. How old are sandpiper fledglings when it's time to migrate?
They're not very old. It's one of the most remarkable things to me about shorebirds. The eggs are laid early June and incubated during June, and many of them hatch early July. So by the time early to mid-August comes around, they're only about a month old, and yet they're going to set out on this migration. And to me, the most remarkable thing about it is that the parents are already heading south. Once they've sort of introduced their chicks to the world, they abandon them on the tundra and head out. And they're under a great deal of pressure to get back south on their own migration to survive into the next year. So the chicks, by and large, are on their own out on the tundra trying to decide how to be a bird and then set out for a place that they've never seen. And to me, it's just extraordinary that they can find their way across these vast distances of habitats that they've never seen, and no one's showing them the way, and yet find their way all the way to southern South America.
Mm. What do they learn from their parents?
Well, they're brooded at first when they're born. They're called precocial chicks, which means that they come out of the egg and they're almost ready to walk right away, so they can move around. But they're these tiny little puffballs on stilts, and the parents will brood them just long enough to help them learn to regulate their body temperature as they grow their first body feathers. And then they're get some lessons in foraging and finding their way, and they're taught by imitation to crouch and hide when predators come by. And then very soon the parents are off on their own migration, and the chicks are on their own.
Yeah. Now, do these birds travel in groups, or are they solitary travelers?
It varies a great deal by species. Some of them travel in flocks, and others move singularly across the landscape, so it really depends on the species. Shorebirds, when they're in large flocks, are one of the most beautiful groups of birds to watch because they're expert flyers, and they can sweep and turn together as a flock in really short order so that the wings flash and as the birds turn. It's really an extraordinarily lovely thing to watch.
Yeah. Well, that's something that I have loved watching. I guess it would be the semi-palmated plover on a beach. And if you sit very quietly, you can watch them, you know, and they do that behavior where they will take off, sort of something comes up and startles them perhaps, and
right.
Then they take off and they fly out over the water and then swing back. What are they up to?
Well, they're basically trying not to be eaten, which is an important thing on your migration. I mentioned that there were lots of threats to them on migration. Paradoxically, the recovery of populations of other birds, like peregrine falcons, has increased the pressure on shorebirds during migration. Peregrines are a very effective predator of shorebirds, so they're part of the natural cycle, but as their numbers are increasing,
mm-hmm.
They're recovering from toxic poisoning problems with their eggs. Their populations are growing, and that makes it more of a threat for a shorebird to migrate south.
Mm. Very interesting. Such a delicate balance.
Right.
Let's talk with a listener now in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello. I've always been a bird lover, and I thank you so much for your work. Being a mom, I wanted to ask you a real important question. Mom of three boys and being almost 70, I don't know how anybody could entrust these creatures to nature. Anyhow, would you speak to that issue, please? Because I thank you so much for being on this program.
Well, thank you, and congratulations to you for surviving raising three children. That's quite an accomplishment, especially boys. And I often have the same thought with my own two children that, you know, the many of these birds are raising chicks that are able to function very quickly. And sometimes I ask my children, what's holding you guys up? You've been around for years and years, and you still can't function as well as some of these chicks out of the nest. But basically, it just comes down to the fact that's the system that works the best. What the parents are trying to do is hatch those chicks successfully, but also survive to the next season. And shorebirds have a very small clutch size. That means they only lay, on average, four eggs. And that's their one chance to reproduce for that year. So it's very important to them and for the survival of the species that they survive into the next season. So one of the reasons we think they depart early is to avoid storms that are very intense in the Arctic, and also to avoid the return of those predators, which are going to be a big issue on their southbound migration. So there's a lot of reasons for them to start off south and just trust to the age-old system that the chicks will make it.
Yeah. It's a fledgling's game.
That's right.
Yeah. How many migrations might a shorebird make over the course of its life?
Well, you know, it's very difficult to know how long most shorebirds live. The only records we have are from banded birds. We study them by putting a very small band on one of their legs, sometimes a very small color band that shows a little bit more information about the bird. And it's only when we get recoveries of those birds, either from somebody else who captures the bird somewhere else or more commonly from a bird that's found dead and reports the information that we get any information about longevity. And some shorebirds, like red knots, are known to live into their 20s, and in the process they'll have flown up and down the hemisphere, you know, each year. So it can be a really remarkable total number of miles.
Yeah. I once visited a bird refuge sanctuary in eastern Canada, and Arctic terns were there. A remarkable sight, and I was told that if the bird returns for another breeding season, it will nest in the same spot. Is this something that happens in other species?
We do have a few records of that, and it's quite remarkable. Some of the birds that have been banded on the Arctic tundra do return to the same spot, and we don't know really how common that is because most birds aren't banded, so it's very difficult to tell.
Yeah. Well, and this particular refuge, the number of people who could visit it is very strictly limited. You have to make a reservation long in advance.
Really?
But it was interesting to me to see, you know, here we are, human beings, and we're trying to be as inobtrusive as possible, but occasionally we were seen as a threat. And those small birds were pretty darn fierce when it came to protecting their turf.
They really can be, and I like to think that we need to be equally fierce in protecting their small areas that we've set aside. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is only 5% of the Arctic tundra that's available. So to me, the idea of developing that for oil when it's really only something like a six-month supply at the current rates of use, and that would only be available over decades of extraction. And when you weigh, on the other hand, the fact that many of these birds are struggling for survival, and this is the one place that we've set aside for their protection, I think you have to look at that, those natural, fierce defenders of their nest, and sort of take up their cause and say, this is the only place we've set aside. We're going to make sure that it persists for our children and their children.
Mm. Well, habitat is critical, and one part of the equation that we haven't talked about yet, part of the habitat equation, the habitat question, is global warming. Would you talk about that?
Sure, and I'm really glad you brought that up. We think that some of these habitats may be at significant risk from global warming. In the Arctic, the sea ice is already melting dramatically. We've lost an area twice the size of Texas just in the last decade, and the habitats on land are starting to change. The shorebirds nest on the tundra, which is basically a big grassland, wetland complex, and that habitat is at risk for filling in with shrubs and then trees as global warming causes those plant communities to move north. And that's why it's really important that we very quickly get a handle on global climate change and our emissions. On our website, arcticwings.org, which we put together to provide information about the book, but also to help people, because everyone always wants to know, what can I do? So there's a page there that addresses this issue, some simple things that everyone can do to start limiting our own carbon emissions, basically what we call our carbon footprint, which is the amount that each of us personally contribute to global climate change. We need to act individually and collectively to dramatically limit our emissions of carbon dioxide so that we avoid some of the more catastrophic impacts, such as wholesale loss of habitats and significant sea level rise that threatens many coastal areas. So on that website, arcticwings.org, there's a list, which I hope is helpful to some of your listeners, of at least a place to start, and then some of the organizations where they can find more information about those issues.
And maybe you would talk with us about the work of the Manomet Center for Conservation Sciences.
Sure. Manomet is a small environmental research organization, and we're based in Manomet, Massachusetts, which is just almost as far out from Boston as Cape Cod. We're just on the south shore of Boston. And we do a wide range of different kinds of environmental research. I work in the shorebird program, but we also work on sustainable forestry management. We work on impacts of toxics on wild bird populations. We work on sensible planning of open space in conjunction with development in this region. And we always try to bring science to an environmental problem. So in the case of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, no one knew how important it was for birds. So our approach is always to first do sound science and try to understand the facts, and then to go from there. So now we're in the process through the book of trying to reach out to people and show how important this area really is for the birds that we all enjoy on migration south.
Okay. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Charleston, line 4. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. I just tuned in, but I heard about the ice cap melting. Did your guest make that comment, Celeste, about it receding?
Yes.
Yes. Well, I've just recently been doing some research about John von Neumann. And the last of the article I read about it, that he was proposing putting some sort of dye, dark dye, on the polar ice cap, and that would then raise temperatures enough, and the temperature up there would be just like Hawaii. And this, I wondered if your guest had ever read about that, and this was in 1950.
Well, I've never heard that story, but I could tell you why I think that would be a very bad idea.
Yes.
And basically it comes down to the fact that we really don't want the planet to warm dramatically for a variety of reasons. If you think about global warming, it sounds kind of nice. You know, it would be nice if things were a little warmer most of the time, but really what it means is we're putting more energy into the Earth's weather systems. So if you take away the Arctic ice cap, which is white and bounces most of the light back into space, and replace it instead with dark water, which absorbs most of that energy, you dramatically increase the amount of warming beyond what would have happened. And so what that does is drive increased intensity of storms. It puts more moisture into the atmosphere and causes more flooding in some places. And so there's a lot of reasons why we really don't want to disrupt the very delicate balance that the climate has right now.
Yes, well, I saw Al Gore's global warming piece, and perhaps you would know this too, that I don't hear real well, and I may have missed something he said, but he indicated that in other times, like when the Vikings were around and such, that there was some huge pump in the North Atlantic that organized the wind flow of some sort that preserved the ice cap, and there was, and suddenly it stopped, and I didn't know if it stopped on its own.
Well, that was actually a result of a large amount of fresh water that was dammed up in what became the Great Lakes and then rushed out, and it disrupted what we call the thermohaline circulation, which is basically the Gulf Stream bringing warm water north, and it has a big impact on, particularly on the climate of Europe. So we really don't want that to stop, and the concern is that as more Arctic ice melts, particularly from Greenland, we could cause similar kinds of problems with increasing the freshness of the water in that area so that it no longer sinks and drives that big, very important circulation pattern.
Mm. We've got to wrap up now because we just have a tiny bit of time left. You're headed out there. Soon you'll be out there on the tundra. What's a day out there like for you?
Well, this year we're going to be conducting a coastal survey on about 100 miles of coastline. So a typical day will involve slogging ashore through the mudflats, carrying all of our gear and all of our food and supplies, and then setting off for many miles of surveys along the coast, coming back and then doing it all over again. So we'll be covering a lot of ground, but we'll be going to some places where no one's ever counted shorebirds before and hopefully coming back with some important information.
Well, very good. Well, take care.
Well, thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Stephen Brown has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the director of the Shorebird Conservation Research Program for the Manomet Center for Conservation Sciences. He is the editor of the new book, Arctic Wings, Birds of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And if you're online, you can check them out also at arcticwings.org. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Tom Rogers.
Indeed they are, and they settled lower on the day, particularly the corn and the beans, although the wheat, which had been flat to somewhat higher in the early trade, did finish lower. The main concern, weather, with the extended forecast now calling for a little cooler weather, to fight off some of the heat that we've been feeling. Let's start with the Kansas City Board of Trade. The September wheat contract today had a high of 503.5, the low 489. The settlement price today, 490 and three quarters, down 4¾ cents. December wheat had a high of 517, the low 504. It settled at 505, just off the low, down 6.5. And the March wheat contract had a high of 521, the low 508. It settled at the low, and that was down a nickel. Now to Chicago, where the September wheat contract had a high today of 403, the low today 392.5, the settlement at 393, down 4.5 cents. December wheat had a high of 422.25, the low 412, settled at 412.5, down 5. March wheat had a high today at 438, the low 429, the settlement just off the low at 429.5, down 5.25 cents. The May, the high 443, the low 438, it settled at the low at 438 a bushel, down 5 cents. And July wheat had a high of 454, the low 446. It settled at 446.5, down 2¼ cents. On to the corn pit now. The September contract today had a high of 259.25, the low 251.5, settled at 251 and 3 quarters, down 9 cents. December corn had